Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, it was just yesterday we were talking about how conservatives and Republicans at the state level, particularly places like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, and New Jersey, have really taken on a lot of heat from their opponents and just rolled up their sleeves and tried to do what they can to get their fiscal houses in order. And it's not often that political courage and Lincoln Chafee go in the same sentence, but I guess to some extent, we need to give credit to Rhode Island here in our good martini of the day. There have been several states around the country that have taken on the issue of strengthening their voter identification requirements. Texas has done that and, of course, got a tremendous amount of heat. Florida has done that, taken on a tremendous amount of heat, saying it's absolutely unfair to minorities. It's going to disenfranchise them because apparently they're not allowed to get driver's licenses in those states. But now Rhode Island taking on the issue, and Governor Chafee has signed this legislation and actually said he's gotten huge support from minority communities to make sure that people voting are those who should be voting. So Rhode Island, probably not going to impact their outcome much, given that they're a huge liberal majority there. But the fact that they actually want to make sure that the people who should be voting are the ones voting, I think that's a good martini for them today.
It is a triumph of good policy. And one of the aspects that I think has been driven a lot of the outrage over this, besides the, you know, the Acorn stuff and the sometimes occasionally overwrought, but I think generally well-grounded suspicion that there are serious voter fraud efforts out there, is that anybody who votes out there twice automatically makes all of our votes less worthwhile. You know, let's name our double voter Crook Acorn, just to pick a name at random. And you know, if Crook Acorn votes twice or three times or however, well, that means that, you know, we have one quarter the influence on the election, or one third or one half the election that they have. And you know, you don't have to say, never mind, you know, how Crook Acorn chooses to vote, which is to say, for a Democrat, we all know, even if you're a Democrat, you still have less of a vote. You still have less of a say in this. So it's not surprising to me that this is not something that a certain number of Democrats would say, hey, wait, this is just common sense. You have to show ID to get onto a plane. You have to show ID, sometimes even in some places, to use a credit card to verify your identity. So the idea that this is some sort of draconian or unreasonable expectation in an era where, you know, we get our junk touched and we get our shoes taken off and, you know, TSA agents are getting to third base with us, this is not really an unreasonable expectation. If you want to cast a vote, you better be able to prove that you are who you say you are. And then kind of the flip side of this, the idea of when you see a certain number of Democrats fighting this sort of thing tooth and nail. Greg, if I said to you I had devised a nefarious plan to import Western Canadians, Israelis, Taiwanese, and certain other members of other countries that I'm fairly certain are going to vote for the Republican candidate in 2012, Greg, what would you say to me?
I think that would be a little bit disingenuous and probably illegal.
How about extremely illegal? You know, the idea being that even if we could guarantee a win over Barack Obama, if we had to do it by importing people who were not here to vote legally, to me, that wouldn't even really be winning. I want to convince Americans that the right choice is the right choice, that Obama's putting us on the wrong path. If I have to import other people, it means I've conceded the fight of trying to persuade Americans. And I'm kind of, you know, baffled by that. So the idea that certain, you know, Democrats might believe that they can prosper by lax voting standards and by kind of helping people vote illegally or people, you know, helping people who vote twice or such, I can't even understand that. I mean, obviously, I guess it shows that the attitude is winning is everything and they don't care how they do it. But it's kind of within it is this kind of this concession of, well, if everybody voted legally, there's just no way we could win.
Jim.
You know, they can't convince actual Americans that their policies are the better idea. And I think the, you know, screaming and tearing of hair shirts, et cetera, that they do over this is probably very revealing that they're very frustrated that they have to, you know, go into this election season with the electorate they have, as Secretary Rumsfeld might have put it.
Exactly right. Well, they're obviously terrified about the fact their policies are extremely unpopular. And that'll potentially get them booted. We'll see next.
At least amongst Americans.
Yeah, exactly right. And of course, that's why we got the hand-to-hand combat explanation from the president on the radio show early in the week about what would happen in the fights over policy should Republicans win the White House and the majority in both houses of Congress next year. Well, the president's not content with that violent imagery. The president, in this ridiculous Twitter town hall yesterday, the president had this to say about the debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling should not be something that is used as a gun against the heads of the American people to extract tax breaks for corporate jet owners or oil and gas companies that are making billions of dollars because the price of gasoline has gone up so high.
Now, Jim, last December, when the president agreed to allow the current tax rates to stay the same, or as Democrats would say, extend the Bush tax cuts, he said that he had no choice because Republicans were holding the middle class hostage. Apparently, we're doing that with firearms now. I didn't realize we had that many people with that many guns. But it's interesting the president is still using this tired line about corporate jets, even though it's been less than a week, when folks like Charles Krauthammer are pointing out that it would take you 7,000 years of imposing this tax to make up for 1 year of an Obama deficit. So clearly this is the way America needs to go and all our problems will be solved.
Well, I think, you know, I'm looking forward to the year 2711 when that tax is repealed. I think that the hover car tax will be much easier by that point. You know, I posted this yesterday and looking that, you know, it was not long ago you talked about leaving the political rhetoric at the door and the importance of leaving the ultimatums at the door at President Obama. I guess somebody did and he decided to pick up all those ultimatums and political rhetoric since they were just lying around there. By the way, Greg, if I'm ever going to a meeting with the president and he asks me to leave my political rhetoric at the door, I'd better get some sort of coat check tag type thing because I don't want somebody else, you know, I don't want somebody walking off with it or borrowing mine or something. They put a lot of effort into my political rhetoric. So, but again, I posted this yesterday and a couple of readers were saying, why does he never get called out on this? That he says, oh, it's time for us to be high-minded. And when you're going through this and talking about the violent rhetoric, I was thinking about the Tucson Memorial Service where he talked, you know, they gave this, I thought it was a very beautiful speech about all the victims and how they, so many of them represented the very best of America and said, look, let's be worthy of them. Let's be worthy of the country that they believed in. And then he goes, and then he does this. And then, you know, he says, let's, my opponents are shooting hostages. They're, you know, it's, you know, I'm wondering if he's going to do the Keanu Reeves strategy and speed and shoot the hostage in order to resolve the situation. But again, this is you know, Obama, who began his presidency, his inaugural speech of saying it's time to put aside childish things, has no problem, you know, doing a de facto tantrum and behaving very childish himself. And I don't know whether Tabitha Hale, who's on my Twitter feed, was observing this is perhaps one of the least self-aware presidents we've ever had. And the degree to which he will contradict himself sometimes from one sentence to the next indicates somebody who does not. For all the time he looks in the mirror, he never really sees himself, which I guess might be the definition of narcissism.
It could Brad. Be. And taking the advice of President Obama or Keanu Reeves is probably a bad policy to follow in life in general. But the president wasn't just comparing the Republicans to hostage takers and people holding guns to other people's heads. He also talked about a number of other issues, including what he claims is the tight fiscal discipline in terms of pay for White House staffers.
By the way, people who work in the White House, they've had their pay frozen since I came in, our high-wage folks. So they haven't had a raise in 2.5 years, and that's appropriate because a lot of ordinary folks out there haven't either. In fact, they've seen their pay cut in some cases.
Well, let's go to the actual facts here. According to a report on Gawker.com, I believe John Cook's the author of this, and pardon me, there's a little bit of detail here. An astonishing 75% of continuing staffers got raises from 2009 to 2010. I'm pretty sure that Obama was president then. This time around, from 2010 to 2011, the ratio is a little less dramatic. Of the 270 White House staffers who have been there for more than a year, 54% received raises. Now, the president tried to throw in a little proviso there for those who are the higher paid staffers, but there's huge staff raises going on here. One person got an 82% raise from $59,000 to $130,000. Another one got a raise from $114,000 to $130,000, and they're trying to couch that by saying, well, he actually left for a little bit of time, came back with slightly different responsibilities, so it's a different salary. But clearly, what the president just said is incontrovertibly false.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is, you know, pretty much Obama standard of saying one thing, and then you look at the facts, and the facts are not quite what he said. I suppose what he says is that he hasn't gotten a raise, and so as far as he looked, you know, that stuff. This is, you know, typically frustrating from the Obama administration. He will come out and he will make a very bold-sounding promise. You know, some workers are getting very minor raises, and, you know, look at the private sector. Heck, unemployment's still 9.1%. That's not, you know, the least bit surprising. I think the one that you looked at, you know, that particularly amazing hike was from the economic policy guy, Matthew Vogel. Now, is there any place where you think things have been fantastic for the president? Has been economic? How does this guy go in and say, look, Mr. President, unemployment's really high. The housing markets haven't recovered.
the only thing going well in the economy is corporate profits, and as you like to demonize them and say they're not really a good indicator of fiscal health, clearly, I need my pay almost doubled. And somehow he got it. I don't know how that happened there. But again, you know, one rule for thee, one rule for me. It's pretty much standard. I'd love to know what these considerable additional responsibilities were. I hope he's like at least cleaning up the offices and picking up waste paper baskets and cleaning out the fridge, the office fridge at the end of the week. Or like doing useful stuff that might be able to justify all of that. So
exactly.
We'll see what happens. But that's, again, this is, well, you know, it's unfortunate. Great. I'm not even surprised by this anymore.
No, not at all. And, you know,
we can try to laugh about it. We can mock him for it. But, you know, I think almost everybody, as soon as you said Obama said about White House raises, everybody's like, oh, yeah, that's completely false. You know, they kind of figured that it was, you know, it was standard for Obama. The expiration date came as he was speaking.
So Joe Biden's record has been broken, apparently. Jim, just very interesting. Of course, if Jay Carney gets asked about this in the days ahead, he's going to try to hang his head on the $100,000 barrier. But as I recall, the president put it out there blankly several months ago that all federal salaries were going to be frozen in place. I don't remember him making that distinction, but I'm sure they'll try to distract us with a bunch of smoke and mirrors on that, only to have the media completely ignore it.
It's the, you know, look, at this point, I'm somewhere, I think Bill Clinton is saying, man, does this guy parse his words? Why can't he just give a straight answer the way I used to?
More parsing tomorrow. Jim, have a great day.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.